Are there handouts? Should I, like,
The House Committee on Revenue will, for February 7, 2017, will come to order. We're going to start at the top of the calendar with the informational meeting, Secretary of State Audit Report on Tax Incentives. Paul, would you like to introduce that? And I think we have some people here ready to come up and...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Secretary of State Audits Division issued a report on economic development incentives, looking particularly at some of the property tax incentives that the state has used. We thought this was consistent with a lot of the work that the committee has done on regarding tax expenditures over the years. So they have some recommendations and some analysis to present to you. And then we've also asked Business Oregon to respond, and they've got some information in the report as well. The report is posted on OLS.
Great. Whoever's first.
All right. Good afternoon.
If you would
Chair
state Barnhart. Your name for the record and then give your testimony.
Sure. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Steve Elzinga, and I'm the Governmental and Legal Affairs Director for Oregon Secretary of State Dennis Richardson. And we're here today to discuss the audit of Business Oregon that was completed in December of 2016. We want to highlight several recommendations our auditing team made to improve incentive and loan information available to policymakers and the public. First of all, Business Oregon can make an immediate impact by working with state and local governments to disclose all business awards and their benefits to the public. The agency already has access to this data and could post it to Oregon's transparency website. The agency could also provide more information on the success of its incentive and loan programs by conducting and reporting more frequent and deeper evaluations. Evaluations should focus on program-level outcomes like job creation and tax revenue generation. For a more in-depth discussion of the audit, I'm pleased to introduce two of our hardworking members of our auditing team.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. My name is Sharon Blasey, and I am an audit manager for the Oregon Audits Division. With me today is Andrew Love, who led this audit. The purpose of this audit was to determine whether...
If you would move the microphone slightly further away from you, it will distort less.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry. The purpose of this audit was to determine whether Business Oregon regularly evaluates and reports on economic development incentives and loans given to businesses. The incentive and loan numbers are pretty substantial. Total incentives and loans are expected to be $680 million for the 2015-17 biennium. Most of that, about $535 million, is from local property tax exemptions. The rest is for state loans, forgivable loans, and tax incentives. The first part of our audit examined Business Oregon's evaluation of these programs. Overall, we found that Business Oregon does conduct some evaluations, but it doesn't regularly evaluate and report some key results at the program level, including jobs created and retained, wages, and return on investment. Other states, some with more staff for program evaluation, evaluate and disclose outcomes for their incentives and loan programs more regularly and thoroughly. Wisconsin, for example, produces an annual report that details investments and outcomes for each of its economic development incentives. We wanted to demonstrate the potential benefits of deeper evaluation, so we analyzed forgivable loans from Business Oregon's Strategic Reserve Fund and Business Expansion Program, and loans and guarantees from its business finance programs. We pick those programs because they're the most under Business Oregon's control. We also used Employment Department data that Business Oregon receives already. For our analysis, we looked at 231 awards Business Oregon gave in 2011-2012. We asked the Employment Department for jobs and wage data for those businesses to see how they performed after receiving the awards. We found that the businesses did generate new jobs overall. The estimated income taxes new workers paid also generated positive returns to the state. But we also found that the majority of awards went to businesses with average wages below that of the county they operated in. And for a 10-year period from 2006 to 2015, most of Business Oregon's awards went to urban areas. Business Oregon did not have targets for rural investment and wages, making it more difficult to evaluate the results. We think these are the kinds of important issues that regular deeper evaluation can highlight for policymakers and for the public. We also analyzed property tax exemptions in enterprise zones in 2015 because the enterprise zones are Oregon's most widely used local incentives. We saw a high job growth in the Portland metro area zones, and more generally in areas considered non-distressed economically. We also found high tax exemptions for jobs for data centers. And we found high exemptions per job in the long-term rural enterprise zone programs at $54,500 in 2015. Again, regular deeper evaluation can highlight these sorts of issues for discussion. Enterprise zone credits, other local credits, and state tax credits do get some additional evaluation now. The governor's tax expenditure report, which comes out biennially, included some very high-level evaluation of these tax expenditures. But those evaluations do not detail outcomes such as job growth and wages. The Legislative Revenue Office also evaluates tax credits in depth shortly before they are scheduled by law to sunset. These in-depth reviews of tax credit performance are a nationally recognized improvement in Oregon's tax credit oversight. But several tax incentives do not have sunset dates. That includes the Strategic Investment Program, which is Oregon's largest local tax incentive, and tax deductions such as the Oregon Investment Advantage. And the reviews may not be timely. Enterprise zone property tax exemptions were last reviewed in depth in 2009 and are not due for another review until 2025. Deferring an in-depth review until 2025 may delay important program adjustments. The second major portion of our audit was analyzing the transparency of the economic development awards, which is basically whether agencies disclose individual awards to businesses. To evaluate transparency, we looked at the disclosure of awards on Oregon's Transparency website. Oregon's transparency reporting has improved a lot, but it still has a ways to go. The reporting generally meets state statutes and guidelines, but 10 of the 15 programs we reviewed did not disclose outcomes such as jobs and wages. The programs that did not disclose outcomes included the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund, the Oregon Innovation Council, and Business Oregon's various loan programs. For 4 of the 8 tax incentives we evaluated, agencies did not report the tax credits or subtractions given to individual businesses, citing tax return confidentiality. For example, state tax credits for companies in long-term rural enterprise zones are not disclosed individually or in aggregate. There is essentially no disclosure on these tax credits. We also found inconsistent reporting of enterprise tax zone exemptions to the state. About a fifth of the standard enterprise zone projects that assessors reported in 2015 had missing job or wage information. Reports for property tax exemptions in long-term rural enterprise zones had no information on wages and jobs. Business Oregon officials are concerned that additional transparency requirements could reduce business demand on the state's incentives and loans. But officials from other states told us they did not think the increased transparency has reduced demand for their programs. Mm. They also told us they think transparency has helped them improve the programs. We concluded that policymakers and the public do not have enough information on many economic development awards to assess their value and review jobs and wages generated by subsidized businesses. Our final area of review was on Business Oregon's selection process for the Governor's Strategic Reserve Fund awards to private businesses. Those are usually forgivable loans, forgiven if the business meets job goals. Our main finding in this area is that Business Oregon is focusing solely on Strategic Reserve Fund award amounts when evaluating potential returns to the state and risk to the taxpayer. It is not analyzing all of the state's investments, which can be substantial on large projects. We evaluated 7 large projects that received Strategic Reserve Fund awards from 2008 to 2015. For 5 of those projects, adding estimated state tax credits alone to the return analysis would have increased the estimated payback period to the state to 24 years on average. That's up from 3 years when only the SRF award is taken into account. Our recommendations address all of these areas. On evaluation, we recommended that Business Oregon develop additional metrics for evaluating incentive and loan program performance, and that the agency report the results of those evaluations to the public and policymakers. The metrics could potentially include rural investment and wage targets. We also recommended transparency improvements. Business Oregon should publicly report individual strategic reserve fund and business expansion program awards, as well as business finance loans. It should also work with the legislature to improve the quality and completeness of transparency disclosure. Transparency statutes are incomplete because they exclude some programs and all loans. They also restrict Business Oregon and other agencies from compiling new data or using additional staff time to comply with disclosure requirements. That provision is designed to save resources but hinders transparency. Finally, we recommend that the agency further improve its selection process for the Strategic Reserve Fund awards. We believe all of these improvements would help the agency, the legislature, and the public to ensure business incentives and loans are cost-effective and productive. We also believe that Business Oregon's expertise and its role as the state's leading economic development agency put it in the best position to evaluate economic development investments. Thank you, and we're happy to answer any questions you have on the report.
Thank you.
Do we have Business Oregon's response? Business Oregon's here, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. I don't see any questions for you.
Great.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, will this be our only time to ask questions of this panel?
I am quite certain that the Secretary of State will make them available to you if you have questions.
I was just curious if I could just ask.
Please, yeah.
Did you have an opportunity regarding the Strategic Reserve Fund? Did you have an opportunity to go out and personally review and see on site the projects that were completed? Or is this all coming out of Salem?
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, our work was basically looking at the documentation and the evaluation of those programs. We didn't go out to evaluate whether we thought these programs were good programs because we, in our opinion, our goal was to make sure that information is out there so that policymakers and the public can assess whether these are beneficial to the state. So we were really just trying to shine a light to what the benefits of these programs are.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So part of the Strategic Reserve Fund is, in my view, is also look at the community impact of those investments. Did you have a chance to talk with chambers of commerce or county commissioners or city mayors about how the Strategic Reserve impacted the projects in those seven that you reviewed?
Not specifically. We did speak with stakeholders in the beginning of the audit and talked about the economic development incentives that are available, and they did note that the Strategic Reserve Fund was one of the state's best methods for job creation.
Further question? Mm-hmm. On the Enterprise Zone analysis, was there any conversation with the Enterprise Zone managers themselves as to how the programs are being operated?
Yes, we did.
At the local community?
Yes, excuse me, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. We did interview several of the zone managers, and they talked about how they thought the programs were working well and their work challenges in terms of managing and evaluating job creation.
I'll hold the rest of my questions for now, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you all for the work. As someone who has done some work on overall corporate transparency, I think this is very important information because, indeed, I think that the economic development that we do through these is some of the most important work that we do as a state, that I am a great believer in the policies in general. And I believe that the point is if we use these policies to make, if we have policy goals in them and we don't know how and we're not getting an accurate picture of the returns, it's hard for us to know. I completely acknowledge my colleague's points, which are there are other broader impacts, and as a state and as policy, when we specifically say this is for job goals and other things, if we're not then getting that information back, we really aren't, we don't have all the information. So I wanted to thank you for that. And I have put in a draft of a bill to indeed implement most of the recommendations in the report. And I look forward to kind of checking in with you guys on whether you agree with the draft, on whether that's the best way to go about that. Mm-hmm. So I guess that wasn't really a question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I read your report carefully. I found it extremely interesting and enlightening. There's a couple of parts in it, though, that I thought were – I was on the Transportation Economic Development Committee for many years. Mm-hmm. This is the first year, in fact, I haven't been on it. And I was struck many times by how broad that word economic is, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. how challenging it is to be in the department that this audit reviewed. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that some of the suggestions in the audit were probably better directed at perhaps this committee and others than at that particular department. And I was looking at, mm-hmm. For example, page 13 and other pages having to do with the tax credits. And the reason I raise the issue is I remember asking the director, the then director of the department, why that department wasn't coming before us, since it was in kind of, as it's said in here, you're kind of our lead organization when it comes to our economic posture, and telling this group here what to do with tax policy, not just tax credit, mm-hmm. but income tax and all the crazy gyrations thereof for corporate tax. Mm-hmm. Because the tax credit piece is a very modest piece in a much broader environment of tax expenditures, for example. So it seemed to me that some of the language here could have been a bit more narrow and perhaps directed more as just making suggestions and recommendations. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe you've done that. But I'm looking forward to when they come up to ask him those kind of questions. But again, I just want to say, from an auditor standpoint, on a performance audits basis, looking at the mission and working your way down through it, it seemed to me that you might have misdirected your exhortations just a bit. Other than that, fine product, great work.
Thank you.
Yeah. Criticizing the legislature usually is not a high outcome probability, high probability outcome. But we can do it to ourselves,
sure.
Can't we?
Exactly.
Representative Noes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. I thought we already required tax expenditures to be reviewed every 6 years, and the report suggests that maybe we're not doing that. Are there certain ones we don't look at?
Representative Noes, Mr. Chair. You have a systematic review of the tax credits, which would be the income tax credits. The other tax expenditures, the tax subtractions, for example, you don't have a systematic process on that.
Okay, so there's a difference between the credit and the expenditure.
Yes, and mm-hmm. the other issue that they raised specifically in the audit is the property tax exemptions. We have looked at, we've had some bills introduced in the past that have tried to set up a process to do that. It's property tax is mammoth, and there's a lot of exemptions that really don't, that are really beyond your policy control. So what we've did, partially based on the recommendation of the audit, we requested a draft to try again on a property tax sunset exemption system. So you'll have that bill to look at here shortly.
All right. So you have some bills. We have some bills in the committee who are coming that will look at some of these recommendations. Mm-hmm. Representative Bennett?
Mr. Chair, I just want to mention, I did go back in anticipation of a question of that nature. I went back to look. And we do have 367 tax expenditures, and this year we have 15 tax credits that we're going to review. So if we choose to take that on, boy, is it a lot of work.
Yes. Yeah. And, of course, we've had work groups working on various aspects of this, and I think it's fair to say that those work groups experienced exactly what Representative Bench just said.
Mm-hmm. Lots of work.
Lots of work. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question, as it relates to confidentiality. How do you manage that in small rural communities where it'd be very easy to identify a company and it'd be very easy for the company's information to be utilized by competitors, not only in Oregon, but in other states?
So there was, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, there was two areas of confidentiality that we looked at. One, the portion that has to do with evaluation and program evaluation. So when we're talking about the Strategic Reserve Fund and evaluating job creation and those outcomes, you would have to aggregate those numbers so that you can't tell the individual programs. You're talking about the program itself. You can't tell the individual businesses. Those are some of the challenges we faced when we were even reporting some of this information. We weren't able to organize the data in a certain way that we wanted. One of the things that we thought we would do is put together a map that shows where investments are going in the state, but doing so may be able to identify specifically some of those confidentiality things. So other states do not rely on employment data for mm-hmm. job creation numbers. It's self-reported, mm-hmm. and so that's how they get by some of those confidentiality rules for employment data.
So just really quick, though, so if I'm a competitor, wouldn't it be easy for me to go and look at our transparency website and see if a company is in a growth mode or in a retraction mode and be able to make business decisions with my competitors?
Possibly. However, some of that information, if you look at property taxes, they already report. So a corporation may get a strategic reserve fund and may get another loan, but also has a property tax, and they're already reporting the job growth. So we're reporting it in some things, and some things we are not. Other states, there is that risk, but they chose to go with transparency, being that it's the public's money, that there is some risk of assigned to it and when you accept public monies, but part of that is disclosure, and it's important.
And Mr. Chair, I'm not trying to be objectionary. I'm just trying to point out that this isn't as easy as it appears, and so I appreciate the work you've done, but this does get pretty tricky.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for your good work here. I've been around the building long enough been on the receiving end of a number of audits from the Secretary of State's audits for various agencies and so forth that seem to we get their day in the light here now, but then the report gets set on the shelf somewhere and nobody revisits it, and we don't really get a follow-up about what actions might happen pursuant to the recommendations that you make. So I think our current Secretary of State maybe is going to pursue a little different pathway, but I would just say that whatever mechanisms you all might want to employ to make sure that, you know, for the legitimate, you know, things that you point out that could be improved upon, that we are in hearing about how that's improving the efficiency and, you know, the transparency of state government and so forth, so that taxpayers are really being well served.
If I could respond,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson. Yes, Secretary of State Dennis Richardson is excited to change a little bit of the approach of the Secretary of State's office, in that we will be going back and looking at prior audits that have been released under previous Secretaries of State, as well as ongoing as we release audits and coming back to the legislature, because you are the policymakers, you are the accountability watchdogs on behalf of the people of Oregon. And we want to equip you with that information so you know, are agencies being responsive to recommendations, what's happening with recommendations, and we'll be especially working with Ways and Means on that, but policy committees as, you know, depending on the audit, too.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much for your presentation today. Food for thought.
Yes. Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Bentz, Vice Chair Smith Warner, I'm Chris Harder, the Director of Business Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to provide remarks on the Secretary of State audit for economic development, incentives, and loans. I would first like to acknowledge the professional work of the audit division in preparing their report. The team was a pleasure to work with. My agency invests in Oregon communities, businesses, and people to promote a globally competitive, diverse, and inclusive economy. How we approach this work is both broad and deep. It includes rural community development and infrastructure financing, business retention, expansion, and recruitment, export promotion, investments in industry innovation, and technical assistance to small businesses. Financial assistance to companies is just one tool we use to support business growth. We believe our agency's incentives and loans are important to ensure a competitive Oregon economy and contribute to economic prosperity in rural and urban areas. The audit report is also consistent with the strategic planning process we launched in September of this year, which will inform the use of incentives and loans going forward. Our strategic planning process has identified investment priorities related to rural prosperity, economic opportunity for underserved populations, small business growth and innovation, and quality job creation. The process will also include updating agency-level success metrics and program-level targets and goals. Business Oregon generally agrees with the audit recommendations. As such, we welcome the Secretary of State's assessments as a means to help us improve the use and effectiveness of our programs and services. With me today is Ramona Rademacher, Assistant Director for Operations and Finance, who served as our agency point during the audit. I'd now like to turn it over to Ramona, who will walk through our management response.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ramona Rademacher, and as Director Harder said, I'm the Assistant Director for Operations and Finance at Business Oregon. To begin with, I want to highlight some of the overarching findings of taken directly from the Secretary of State's audit report and build on those as I continue. As they stated, number one, Business Oregon programs helped add new jobs, and workers filling those jobs generated positive returns to the state through income tax payments. And that was one of the first findings in the report. Secondly, another thing that was included in that report is that Oregon has recently made a number of improvements in reporting awards to individual businesses, putting it near the top in state rankings and improving public accountability. We recognize there's always improvements that can be made, but we're very proud of that achievement. And third, Business Oregon has developed new and more thorough processes for making its strategic reserve fund award decisions, and we continue on that road and continue to enhance that process. And so while we appreciate the work, the report's recognition of the work we've already done thus far, we remain committed to continually improving upon that work and to refining our processes and building on the successes that we've experienced so far. To summarize our management response, I want to note three areas in which we have already taken significant steps to address the Secretary of State recommendations. And I also want to note two areas where we will continue to explore the options that are available to us to comply, but that aren't as clear moving forward. Even though the audit just came out in December 2016, we've already taken a number of steps in addition to the strategic planning activities that Director Harder referenced to make additional improvements to our processes. Number one, we have, as a result of the Secretary of State audit and also a result of an internal audit that we asked for ourselves in 2015, we have begun to build upon our strategic reserve fund decision-making, contracting, and monitoring processes. And that's as part of our effort to use thorough underwriting processes to ensure that we're making good decisions not only with our business loans, but also with our incentive awards. To date, the changes that we've made to the decision-making, contracting, and monitoring processes include the following. We have incorporated, before any decisions are made around making SRF or Strategic Reserve Fund awards, a comprehensive review of the company's financial situation, including the pros and the cons of that individual company's outlook. We also began instituting monthly meetings in which time we bring together a multidisciplinary team to review the application and the financial statements of the company. And we discuss and address any concerns that we have. And the way that we generally address that is we may make the decision to not make the award if it doesn't appear as if the repayment is possible. But more commonly, we have a discussion if it's possible to modify the loan terms and conditions so that we can make it more likely that they're able to meet the job creation and income tax creation goals for a project. And lastly, we are sharing these deliberations with the governor and her staff before requesting signature. And so each of the strategic reserve fund decisions that we're making are being thoroughly vetted by the local representative, our SRF coordinator, the director, and anybody else who has additional information about that company that they can bring to light. These improvements were completed and implemented in last month, in January of 2017, as we stated in our management response letter. The second thing that we have been working on is that while, to our knowledge, we have always been in compliance with all statutory requirements and transparency statutes and guidelines in the state, in October 2016, we took the initiative to work with the DAS Office of Transparency to create a web link on their page so that we will be able to have more control over the data sets and to be able to upload timely and relevant data. So we're not just answering the questions that the transparency surveys ask us, but instead we're able to, this is a first step in enabling us to determine what that appropriate program level data is and making it available to people so that they can come directly to our site and see that information. We've also put a reciprocal link on our page directing them to the Office of Transparency information. And so that is something that was done in October of 2016. And it's something that we had been working on all along, again, for the commitment to continuous improvement. Lastly, the report recommended that we develop policies and procedures for changing loan terms when we amend a loan agreement. And we've begun to address these processes as we've upgraded our contracting and monitoring workflows. In fact, the monthly meeting that I referenced earlier, that's one of the decision points in that meeting, is really going forward and having the conversations about what needs to be considered when amending or extending any particular contracts. We plan to further define these conditions and outline a menu of contracting options and terms and to use that multidisciplinary team that I referenced earlier to review these decisions before they're implemented. And one of the recommendations in the report is that they wanted us to have any contract amendments that we entered into available electronically. While we think that amending our current database would be cost prohibitive, we are right now looking at and are committed to tracking future loan modifications in a searchable spreadsheet and making that information available to the public. The two recommendations from the audit where we believe we need to do some more thinking and put some more consideration into how it is that we would comply are as follows. The audit recommends that we require a sunset review of all tax expenditures and ensure enterprise zone reports are complete and accurate, including job and wage data for long-term rural enterprise zones. While we have a long history of contributing and participating in these reviews, and we're committed to continuing to do so in the future, we don't currently possess the authority to direct these activities. Our role is primarily when a local government wants to create an enterprise zone, we determine whether or not they've met the legal requirements before they're established. local governments, tax assessors, the Legislative Revenue Office, and the Department of Revenue are better positioned probably to assess and report on this data. And they have easier access to the data and also have the staffing to be able to implement this specific recommendation. And we'll continue to participate in any way that we can. We just don't believe that we're in the best position to lead the effort. Secondarily, the audit recommends that we work with other agencies and the legislature to address current disclosure limitations due to confidentiality rules and laws. This recommendation would require law changes. The current state law prohibits us from disclosing individual or business financial information or tax records. And when we get job data from the employment department, we have to sign an interagency agreement that specifically says that we will not disclose any wage or job creation information if it can be attributed to a specific company. We can disclose aggregate information, which we do, but it is more difficult for us to talk about actual verifiable job creation data, given where we get that data from. And so, I mean, that really concludes the main points of our management response to the Secretary of State's Economic Development Audit. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
Question, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. As I mentioned to the earlier panel, really the work that Business Oregon does is critical to our economic development, and I thank you all for what you do. On the Strategic Reserve Fund, so I appreciate the expanded process. That sounds like a great response to this. One of the kind of big issues I thought in the audit was also in, I guess, is there a place in the reviewing of the company's financials to deal with the whole, the kind of bigger picture of, are they also receiving tax expenditures and other things as far as what the long-term, you know, kind of cost per, the cost-benefit analysis that we're that we're receiving from that? Is there a place in your kind of improved process for that to be taken into account, or is that still a gap that you're figuring out how to address?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner. We do note what other agencies or incentives may be available, but when we make these decisions, we generally make them based on program requirements. And so, you know, if we're making a loan, we make loan decisions the same way banks make loan decisions. You know, are you creditworthy? Can you pay it back? For the incentives, when we're making a determination about whether or not a project is something we want to go forward on, we are making those decisions based on usually is it going to be able to create the number of jobs at the wage level that we expect to be able to pay for this investment. And so we do limit currently our decision making about return on investment to our own programs as opposed to the overall statewide investment. I mean, as the Secretary of State auditors correctly determined, when you're looking at the $680 million that this report is looking at, only about $145 million of that is within our direct control. Most of that is being controlled by local governments, other agencies, you know, and so we are really generally making the decision based on the program requirements for that particular program.
Okay. Follow up,
please. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds to me like that may not be the best place for the overall return on investment kind of assessment necessarily.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner, I think when we're in a project and we know of those, I don't think we have any issue making sure that the full picture is available. Some of the projects, particularly related to Strategic Reserve Fund, are complex and over a longer period of time. So, and they involve many actors from federal to state to local. So So compiling all that is a time, in some cases, a timing issue. In terms of return on investment, if you're doing it related to jobs, I think it's a fair discussion to say those incentives specific to job creation. But as we know, there are projects where we have job creation incentives, we have infrastructure funds going in, and you know, I think we have to caution ourselves to tie every element of financial assistance to job creation there as well. So I think they're good points. We're looking into how we can improve that. I do think it's, as always on these projects, they can be more complicated and less black and white.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Of all the programs that receive money from the Strategic Reserve Fund, how many involve clawbacks?
Our so the Strategic Reserve Fund focuses on job creation, which have the clawbacks, capacity development. So we, out of the Strategic Reserve Fund, have funded a rural entrepreneurship program, for example, and I'm now blanking on the third.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller, I would say that a good estimate would be about 80% of the Strategic Reserve projects that we do have clawback provisions. Generally speaking, they are awarded as a forgivable loan, and if the company is unable to meet the job creation or income tax generation requirements, then they are required to pay back that loan.
Yeah, so the job creation ones have the clawbacks. The other SRFs obviously aren't job creation focused.
Mm-hmm.
So 80% of the SRFs, such as approved by the governor's office, have clawback provisions. Of those 80%, how many actually failed to perform on their performance requirements and actually paid money back to state coffers?
We can get you that information.
Give me a rough estimate. Zero, 10? 60, 50?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller. We define the success of a strategic reserve fund investment as either the creation of the job or income tax requirements or the payment of the loan. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of the strategic reserve funds do one or the other. And we'll have to get you the exact number, but when they haven't created the jobs or income, then they are required to pay that back, and that also is viewed as a successful loan because the money gets returned to the state.
Okay, so you'll get that information too. Thank
you. That would be extremely helpful, I think. If I could follow up, I'm assuming that part of what Representative Bueller is reaching for is the success of your predictor. If you're predicting that people are going to act in a certain way, how often do they actually do that? So it sounds like there's basically three different outcome possibilities. One is, yes, they predicted the way you expected them to do, and you forgave the loan. The second one is they did not, but they were financially capable of repaying the loan, and they did. And the third is neither of the above. I think that's the kind of number you're interested in, isn't it?
Or we don't know.
Well, of course, ones that are underway, we don't know.
Yeah, or we didn't follow up on it. I mean, we do have a history of these type of loan programs with the Business Energy Tax Credit, where there has been questionable administration and follow-up of the allocations.
One of the metrics that we absolutely do track is the default rate, and we have an extremely low default rate, and that really, so the answer to the question is I don't know the percentage off the top of my head, but I do know that over the last many years, it is a handful of companies. It is not the trend by any stretch of the imagination.
Thank you. I assume, to follow up on that you use this information in your postmortem, as it were, on your own decision-making process so that you can do better in the future. I thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Director, I believe the third criteria is in-state purchases or contracting opportunities generated is a criteria for the strategic reserve. Let me ask this question. The comment was made earlier that within the strategic reserve fund, if there's a loan modification, those are now going to become public. We're going to be more transparent. What's going to be the impact to your business development officers when they have to share that with companies?
So I'll answer it at a high level, and I'll have Ramona jump in. So Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith, you know, our loan modifications are public, and we have those on file. So sharing basic kind of information related to their, I think, is something we're looking into, and to build off what Ramona had mentioned about confidentiality and being an area that I think we'd very much like to explore in more detail, to do it the right way, to preserve business competitiveness with the right for the public to know. So to answer your question, I think it's something we're going to look into, and would advocate that we do that in the right way to protect both interests there. So I think you raise a good point.
Yeah, and then just as a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
I think it's important for folks to really understand what the Strategic Reserve Fund is about. Mm-hmm. It's a tool to attract industries to communities and to be that last source of capital in to help a company make that final decision. And there's a tremendous amount of political pressure that gets placed upon the department by local governments, by local economic development professionals, by elected officials who are trying to attract these companies into their community. And the Strategic Reserve Fund has been a great tool, but there is some risk inherent with it. And I think we as a body need to recognize there is risk inherent with the Strategic Reserve Fund. And we also need to realize, I appreciate you pointing out there's just a handful. I would ask, how many companies would we have lost coming to Oregon without the Strategic Reserve Fund?
That's probably not an answer for today, but
it's a rhetorical question.
It is rhetorical. I would have you go ask
Gary Neal at the Port of Morrow. I'd have you go ask folks in Astoria. I'd have you go ask folks in Central Oregon what the Strategic Reserve Fund has meant to them.
Would a corollary to what you just said be, if you don't lose some of it, you're not risking enough? Because if you're not wrong once in a while, your cutoff score is too low.
Maybe said.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually have I'm not sure if it's a question for you guys or for my colleague here, but the fact of receiving the fund is not secret, is it? Or is it public record that a company is receiving it? It is public record that you receive it, right?
It is public record.
Okay.
Here's the situation, Mr. Chair, if I can address
this. Please, yeah, go ahead.
And please, colleagues,
this is a good time for a conversation on this particular topic.
For public disclosure, I do economic development for a living, and so I want to be very transparent with the group. What ends up happening is a company comes in, they're interested in a community, and every community asks the same thing. What can you do to help us locate here? And then they play you off of the next community.
Right.
And then they play you off the next state. And if you're competing against Idaho or Nevada or California or Washington, it gets very, very tricky. And our world's even gotten larger now to where we're competing against Utah and Arizona and Montana, et cetera. And so the Strategic Reserve Fund is that tool to attract high-quality companies to come to the community, but they're very protective of their information. These are sophisticated organizations with sophisticated finance departments, and they're guarded. They're very guarded. And so the first time you share with them that they're going to have to open their books to the public, they're like, we're out. And I just personally have seen that many times. Mm-hmm.
Could I suggest that one of the things that would be helpful for us, when all these witnesses are still here, is to sort of play off of that insight from Representative Smith and ask the extent to which other states have actually managed to make data of this type public that we aren't making public, and the extent to which we could amend either our statutes or our rules to increase that transparency. It does sound like the Secretary of State's audit suggests that we ought to do that. And I would grant right off the top that Representative Smith's concern is probably very well placed, but what where is that line, and should we move closer to it? And I don't know the answer to that question, but I think that might be something that would be really useful for us to explore. I can tell you, as a sponsor of a whole bunch of transparency bills in past sessions, that I'm in favor of transparency generally, unless we can demonstrate that it's a really bad idea for some reason. And it might, in some cases, be a really bad idea. Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please. Representative Hernandez.
I know that the audit division came up with this recommendation, so you must have looked at other states to come up with that recommendation. Maybe we can ask, what were the findings, briefly?
Yeah.
They mentioned it.
Yeah, and they did mention it in the report, and I expect if we asked them, they could give us. Any of you want to make a comment on that now? Because if you did, you could come back to the table for that purpose.
So,
and if you'd repeat your name for the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Andrew Love, and I was the lead on this audit. Committee Chair Barnhart, committee members. First, I do want to note that the Strategic Reserve Fund, the loan amounts can be found in our expenditure data for the state on the transparency site, and so we did note that information is available. What is not available is where those dollars came from, so it doesn't note that it's a strategic reserve fund, and it doesn't note the job creation, and it doesn't note those things. And I believe the director is correct in saying that this is publicly requestable information, so if someone did want to know this information, it's available. And other states do provide this information. How transparent they are with it depends on the state. Some states have developed websites where you can plug a company's name in and see what all the incentives they have. Wisconsin, you can pull up a spreadsheet that shows every dollar that these companies receive, as well as job creation, tax revenue generated, and those numbers. But it depends on the state and where they've gone with their disclosure.
Okay, so it sounds like we have three levels. One is you're not allowed to do it. The next one is it's public information, but we don't advertise it. Mm-hmm. And the third level is it's out there for everyone to see.
Yeah.
And it sounds like we're talking about the latter two at this stage. Does the director have a comment on this issue today, or do you want to reserve that for later?
Chair Barnhart, as the audit recommended, they looked at some other states. I think for us, I think we would like to have the opportunity to look into those and to kind of reiterate a point. I think we want to find the right balance between mm-hmm. our confidentiality and being competitive with businesses with public disclosure, what those data points are, what the right level is, and how we do that. So I think for us, I think it's something we'd like to look into in more detail.
Okay. Representative Bueller?
But there shouldn't be any concerns about the transparency of the outcomes of the companies that failed to right. fulfill their obligations, either in terms of loans or performance, correct?
Correct.
So that should be forthcoming from you and have no concerns about confidentiality. I mean, I understand the upstream concerns about when people or businesses are applying for them, but after they already are allocated the dollars, the performance criteria are set, we should be able to know if they met those obligations or not.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller, what we're limited by in that particular circumstance is the interagency agreement we have entered into with the Oregon Employment Department. I'm not sure where the requirement is located for them to protect that job creation or wage data, but right now the agreement that we sign with them says that if we disclose that information about a particular company, then they will cease to provide that information to us in the future. And so I believe that we can absolutely say yes or no whether or not they met their job creation goals goals or not, but talking about the patterns of how many jobs they've had over a particular time or whatever is not something that, that we are able to disclose.
Okay. Yes, please.
I just to follow, I'm more interested in, did they default on the loan, yes or no? And did they, if they didn't meet the performance criteria, was there clawback of those dollars? You don't have to get into the details of the agreement. Okay.
All right. Just to follow up, you just added another wrinkle just now to the conversation. Some of the data you have comes from other departments. You have to comply with the restrictions that the other departments have placed on them either by state or federal law. Without necessarily understanding completely what all those limitations are. And they're reflected to you in these interdepartmental agreements. Okay. I think it would be helpful for us to know which of the things that the auditor would like to have you put on the transparency site that you're not allowed to put on the site, either because of your interdepartmental agreements or because of state or federal law or any other reason that forbids you from posting them on the website, on the transparency website, or linked from the transparency website, and those things that you could post but that you choose not to, and those things that you're now going to post because having thought about it, you see it's a good idea. That would be, I think, useful. And I think that goes with the spirit of your question, if I understand it correctly, Representative Bueller.
That's yeah. Right.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel?
Just one.
Please.
I'm going to take it a little higher level. This is hard work.
To
monitor these loans, to monitor the performance criteria. Sometimes they're complex agreements, complex companies. Do you feel like you have adequate expertise within Business Oregon to do this kind of loan and monitoring of performance metrics?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Bueller, I feel we have adequate expertise in some cases. Amount of staff to be able to do some of that reporting would be, I guess, my answer. I feel very confident in the staff that we have, both on the incentives and loan side. Very, very confident in their skills. Reporting in transparency can be a staff resource issue, more so than an expertise issue at times.
Okay. Ways and means question. Thank you. Anything else? I want to thank all of you, all five of you. The audit process is really important for the operation of our government to do it well. The audits that I have reviewed, and I've reviewed a bunch of them, have been very helpful and useful in pointing out places where the legislature and where the executive departments can do better. And I appreciate the audit very much, and I also appreciate that the department takes it within the spirit that it's intended and uses this kind of feedback in a positive way to improve performance, as I think we agree all of us can always do. And thank you all very much for the presentation today.
Thank you.
Everyone here? Everyone's here. Why don't we go next to our work session on possible bill introduction. As usual, bill introduction is simply a way of getting bills before the House. It does not, agreeing to introduce a bill in a committee does not imply a member's agreement or disagreement or any thoughts at all in particular about any particular bill. And with that, I would ask Representative Bence if you have a motion.
Excuse me, Chair, do we need to open a work session?
I'm sorry. Let's open a work session. Thank you. Open a work session for the purpose of bill introduction.
Chair, I move the following LC drafts to be introduced as committee bills: LC 1311 dated 9/26/16, LC 3485 dated 1/13/17, LC 3487 dated 1/17/17, and LC-3491, dated 2/3/17.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves the introduction of LC-1311, LC-3485, LC-3487, LC-3491 as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Close the work session. We have two bills for today. Paul, do you want to, I'm not sure who's on those. Christine? And do we have witnesses on those bills? What have we got in terms of witnesses? They're both on for her. Okay, same people for both of them, so we'll open them together. All right, for that purpose, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2283 and 2284.
Okay.
Please give us an introduction, and then we'll hear from our witnesses. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bills 2283 and 2284 are two administrative bills that the Department of Revenue has proposed for this session. And 2283 would apply any overpayments of tax as of the date that it's paid rather than the due date of the payment. And so this is kind of aligns the amount of interest received with use of the money, the actual use of the money. So it's credited as of the date the payment's actually made, because it's possible to but some of the more administrative details of this can be explained. Department of Revenue is here today to talk about that. House Bill 2284 also expands the provisions for the resolution of conflicting claims to taxpayer dependents to include other types of conflicting claims. And so it kind of allows them to merge information from two different taxpayers' returns. And in order to kind of come to a conclusion about what an actual item of income might be, or other sort of aspects of the tax forms. But also there's possibly, they found a little bit of a necessary edit to make to House Bill 2284, simply stating that a person, it sort of changes some of the language. So on page 1 of the bill, lines 10 to 14, section 1, it would make the terms consistent with the rest of the statute. So right now it reads, when persons make conflicting reports claiming an item of income, it would change that language to when a person files conflicting reports, returns or reports claiming an item of income. And so that's just kind of referring to returns, which is typically the item that the statute addresses, and rather than saying makes the returns, it would say files the returns. So it's possible to, and it just have an amendment to kind of make that statute consistent with the rest of the language around it. Also adds the words returns or reports toward the end there. And every time reports is cited, it just changes that language to returns or reports. Mm-hmm. So with that, Department of Revenue is here.
Wonderful.
All right. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Deanna Mack with Department of Revenue. And today I brought with me Lois Williams, longtime employee of the department, to get some experience testifying with us. So she's going to actually cover both of these two bills. I think they're afraid I might get hit by a bus or something and not be able to make it here. So they're trying to get you guys some backup. Lois is very knowledgeable and has been here for a lot of years. So give the floor to her.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Lois Williams. I work alongside Deanna Mack at the Department of Revenue. Speaking to House Bill 2283 first, as Christine indicated, this is about estimated tax payments and the date to which we post those payments. Oregon law requires that taxpayers make tax payments in four installments throughout the year. Payments are posted as of the date that each payment is made. If a payment is made on May 27th, we post it as of May 27th. That's after the first installment due date of April 15th, but before the second one, so it's part of the second installment, we would apply it accordingly. Additionally, ORS 316-583 allows taxpayers to elect to have their personal income tax credit refund applied to the next year's estimated taxes. The statute currently provides that if the original return is timely filed, including on extension, the refund is to be applied as of the first estimated tax payment installment date, in other words, April 15th. Now, that could result in some backdating of that. Each year, about 10,000 returns are filed where taxpayers make payments after April 15th, but before they get around to filing their return, upon which they file a refund and which they carry over their refund to the subsequent tax year. So if, for example, a taxpayer makes a payment on July 1st for last year's taxes, which they haven't yet filed yet, and then they elect to have that refund applied to the subsequent year's taxes, the statute requires that we backdate their payment and give them credit for it as if that payment had been received on or by April 15th, even though it wasn't actually made till July 1st of the year. This is inconsistent with generally accepted accounting practices. Mm-hmm. Interest is generally paid or charged under the principle that someone had use of the money. This statute currently requires that we post a payment to an earlier date than when the state actually had use of the money. This also creates an inequity for taxpayers who don't elect that application process but just make regular tax estimated tax installments. We don't backdate their payments, so there's some inequity there. So again, this change will align the posting of payments to the dates that they were actually made. And we're happy to answer any questions about that.
Let's deal with this one first because there are different topics. Questions on this bill? Representative Vance, please.
Thank you. So I'm clear on this. So if someone's making a quarterly tax payment, they drop it in the mail on Friday. Let's say it's the 14th, Saturday's the 15th, Sunday's the 16th, Monday's the 17th. What happens under this bill? You get it. It's postmarked appropriately, but it's not received until Monday.
Sure. Chair Barnhart and Representative Vance, we do post it according to what it was intended, and there is a small grace period. We go by the post date in those questionable situations.
So, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Please, yeah.
So I'm just wondering, does the language in this bill change that, is my question? Because I think most people assume that if it's post-dated, postmarked by the due date, they're safe. If we're changing that, we probably should let them know.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Bentz, we are not changing that in any way with this particular proposal. This has to do with the tax return wants the refund carried to the next year. Mm-hmm. The statute says we have to have it as of April 15th. But if the payment had been received on April 16th, say, but the envelope was postmarked by the 15th, it would still be a timely payment as of April 15th. We're talking more about payments, though, that come in later in the summer. June, July, August, sometime before that October 15th filing deadline. They've made an extra payment. Turns out now they've overpaid it. Mm-hmm. But that payment that resulted in the overpayment is getting backdated to April 15th for the subsequent year's estimated tax installments.
And the effect of that is to require you to pay interest?
Oh, go ahead, Deanna.
Okay. Mr. Chair, what the effect of that is a underpayment of interest, the interest on underpayment of tax calculation, it'll affect that for a person. Right now, it gets waived it doesn't get calculated because the payment is credited as of April 15th, even though we don't have it until July 1st, in her example. So it will actually be dated as of the date that the interest is calculated. And if there was an underpayment, if it should have been paid by April 15th and wasn't paid until July 1st, then that'll get accounted for in the schedule that we have people calculate for the underpayment interest, but it would swing both ways.
How does the Internal Revenue Service, Internal Revenue Code, deal with this issue? Do you know?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that I believe they align with what we're asking to do.
Okay.
Yeah.
And has this been run past the Society of CPAs or anybody else who does tax returns?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We work with our partners at the State Bar in the tax section, as well as the Society of CPAs and other practitioner folks, and they're aware of this concept and understand it as well.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, how often does this happen?
Regularly, I'll bet.
Yes. In answer to that, Chair Barnhart and Vice Chair Smith Warner, at least 10,000 on average each year, mm-hmm. if not more. Mm-hmm. 10,000 different taxpayers in that situation, yes.
If I may briefly follow up.
Please, yeah.
Do you think like some CPA somewhere figured this out and said, oh, just do it whenever because you'll still get credited as if you... It just is an inadvertent weirdness of our mm-hmm. ORS right now that we're correcting.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Smith-Warner, we do know that some practitioners have used that because as we go out and provide tax practitioner updates on new laws, for example, we have heard those comments in those presentations.
This is a darn you got me comment, isn't it, that you hear on this one? Any other questions on this bill? If not, let's go on to the other one.
Okay. Thank you. Then again, Lois Williams speaking to House Bill 2284. Oregon statutes stipulate that returns and reports filed by the taxpayers with the department are confidential with very few exceptions. The department takes those confidentiality provisions very seriously because if we were to violate them, it would subject us to severe penalties, and it would also impact taxpayers' confidence in our voluntary compliance system. However, confidentiality provisions sometimes impede our ability for us to perform our work, especially in cases where taxpayers have connected or related income or deduction items, but who file separate tax returns. Mm-hmm. Now, two examples of this type of situation beyond the conflicting dependent claims could be, one, married taxpayers who file separate tax returns but claim itemized deductions, or two, taxpayers who pay or receive alimony or child support between one another. Mm-hmm. This is ineffective for not only the state but also for the taxpayer that has to provide information that we often already have. It would be more convenient for everyone involved to be able, for us to be able to acknowledge that we received a copy of, say, a divorce decree, for example, as part of an audit. As a result of now having that divorce decree, that information, we need to possibly adjust the return of another party who did not report the alimony as income. Hmm. We do not need to disclose whether or by what amount the first taxpayer who provided that divorce decree, what their return may have been adjusted, or even if that it was. We merely want to be able to disclose that we have a copy of that divorce decree and now use it in working with the secondary taxpayer. And, of course, the secondary taxpayer would have due process to provide any additional relevant information on any adjustment to their tax return. The IRS does have this provision that allows for an Internal Revenue Officer to share information in these types of cases where, by rule, they determine that it is related to the correct determination of tax, liability for tax, or the amount to be collected. In summary, we're asking that these amendments be made to remove the current procedural requirements that relate to dependency claims and broaden the types of collateral audit issue information that may be shared between taxpayers to include this provision similar to the IRS. Again, we're happy to answer any questions.
Representative Vance, please.
Okay, sure. How does this come up? How do you see that there's been a conflicting report?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Bentz, often it comes out as a result of opening up one audit. Someone maybe claims a large alimony deduction using this example. And we take a look at it to find out, was it in fact all alimony or was it partly child support? As part of our job then, we do look at who was the alimony paid to. And then separately, we take a look at, did that person claim that alimony as income? So just having information about two taxpayers with a related item or deduction or credit leads us to take a look at both taxpayers. Now, sometimes it can also happen on a dependency exemption, for example, because that comes in first, the return gets processed, another taxpayer then later files a tax return claiming that same dependent, and our computer notices that right away and flags it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? And I think I may have been confused. This is the one that needs some amendment, this bill.
Chair Barnhart, we have recommended some that we feel would just add clarity because right. people do file returns and reports.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, all right. So we'll hold them until we get the amendments, and then and then probably plan a work session unless somebody tells me it's a bad idea. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you notify this other person that there's been recognition of this conflict, what are they entitled to from the other person's materials and evidence?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Vance, currently nothing. Currently, everything that we do with the first taxpayer is held in confidence. Nothing is disclosed. This proposal is to at least be able for us to say, we have a copy of your divorce decree. Currently, we have to be completely silent, and we have to say, Mr. Jones, do you happen to have a divorce decree? Even though he may not have reported anything on his tax return, it becomes very difficult and very awkward when we cannot disclose. And it becomes even more awkward when we ask him for a copy of his divorce decree, which we already have in our possession. It's very inefficient.
Just if I could, this is a public record, isn't it? The divorce decree itself? In the example you're
in
giving?
This example, yeah. Divorce decrees are usually public. Through the county.
Thank you, Sharon. I was just looking for the language that says what you just said the bill does. Is that what you're having clarified? I'm trying to see where it says you can. All it says is, after examining the reports, the department shall notify each claimant reporting the item that the department shall make a joint determination to resolve. Is that language supposed to incorporate the thought that one would explain the nature of the issue to the person that's called?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Bentz, the statute already allows us to disclose this type of information when two people have claimed the same dependent. So further down under Section 1, Paragraph 1, it allows that we can talk about that material with both taxpayers. The changed wording says, let's broaden that to more than just the dependency exemption, but to any item of income, deduction, or credit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, if I may add, the procedure is more like almost impleading someone into the case to bring them in to make sure that everyone is aware of the situation. We don't have to do that at exactly the same time. We can do that one at a time because there may not be a change, but we would be allowed to then talk to these people and make sure that the state is held whole and everyone is entitled to claim what they're actually claiming.
I'm not either.
I'm sorry, I'm just not seeing the language. Maybe I'm looking at the wrong bill.
2284.
I just don't see it.
This language doesn't say what you are reporting or purporting it to say.
It doesn't look to me like it does. In line 17, existing language, it says all such materials shall be available for inspection by the other claimant. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're looking for?
No. I'm looking at the boldface language. I don't know what Representative Vance is looking for. But the boldface language, after examining the reports, the department shall notify each claimant reporting the item that the department shall make a joint determination to resolve the conflicting claims. What does that sentence mean within the context of the example you just gave?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Vance, members of the committee, in this particular example that I gave, is an alimony example. In the example, I indicated that one person, the payor of the alimony, deducted on their tax return, and the receiver of the alimony did not claim it on their tax return. If I may just provide a different type of example where you have two married individuals who choose to file separate tax returns, but they both claim the same mortgage interest deduction. Mm. There's an example where both of them have made the same claim. Yeah. In which case we would want to be able to share with both of them, and as Deanna indicated, indicate who is actually entitled to claim that deduction.
I mean, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Is it the language then up in lines 10 and 11 when claiming an item of income, deduction, or credit? Is that the key language?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's
yes.
It. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair and Representative Bentz, one more thing. It's conflicting reports. So, yeah, it's
yeah,
okay.
I see it.
Good.
So a conflicting report might mean a report on one side and an omission of a report on the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, Chair.
Or it may be, in Lois's example, it may be the exact same amount twice. Those are not what we would expect to see.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, thank you.
It's essentially the same language in the italics, but it adds the kinds of situations within which you can make this claim.
Correct.
Yes.
Okay. Are you, okay, Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wanting to explore the kinds of situations in which you would identify this information. Now, for a dependent, there's actually a Social Security number attached to that person. So they're going to go through the computer, and it's going to kick out in every case when two people have filed for that same dependent, right? So there's always going to be an issue to resolve in those cases. In the case of a mortgage payment or an alimony payment, you're only going to identify those payments unless you do an audit.
Representative Barnhart, Chair Barnhart and Representative Marsh, when people file married filing separate, they are required to provide the Social Security number and the name of their spouse who may be filing a separate tax return.
But you don't automatically, follow-up question?
Yes, please.
You don't automatically pull both of those to see if they're consistent, do you?
Chair Barnhart, that's correct. We don't, just because someone files married filing separate, we don't automatically look at the secondary return. It's only in those cases where there's an indicator of some sort that we should.
And that would be, what would kick those things up other than an audit specifically?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Representative March, we have what we call edits in our system, and they are to trigger all sorts of inconsistencies between taxpayer returns, between, say, a cap on something that you have set in statute, like our federal tax subtraction. There's, if someone claims more than the cap, then that triggers what we call an edit in our system. Mm-hmm. So we have many ways to identify what we call red flags in the system that would cause us maybe to audit it, or cause us, maybe it's a simple one like the federal tax subtraction that would just be an automatic adjustment. But most of those triggers go into what we call like our case selection process in our audit function, and that it causes someone to look at it to say, yeah, this does look like we need to have someone open an audit on it. Does that make sense? Does that help? There's a variety of tools that we have in our system to be able to identify returns that need to be adjusted either by the system or because of math errors or by a set of eyes because we have to open an audit.
A lot of this is related to your new computer system, isn't it? That where things get checked automatically by the system without anybody actually intervening, and then a person becomes involved when the system says this is something you should look at.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Some of the things that we can do in our new system is we've been able to automate our filing enforcement function, for example, where we had people doing that in the past. Our edits, I think, can be smarter in our new system, and so I think we are able to have more focused case selection in our new system. So, yeah, a lot of that is there. This is something we've always kind of, as an auditor, we've kind of like, why can't I look at the other return? Mm-hmm. Why can't I use that divorce decree? It doesn't really make a lot of sense. And so these are situations that I think the agency has wanted to do for a long time, and we've just decided, we decided with our new system, we're going to see if we can get this programmed in and do it this way.
The example you gave, is that particular one a common problem?
Chair Barnhart.
Among the 10,000, I think you suggested that are all together.
Chair Barnhart, the 10,000 dealt with the prior bill with the estimated tax payments.
I'm confused.
But
yes.
I would say it is just as many for this, if not more.
Yeah. Alimony and child support is a very touchy situation for taxpayers because they always, one tries to say, no, it's child support, and the other says, no, it's alimony, and so for the tax benefits related to them. So it is very common in that, and especially in that particular case. Another common one, like we explained, was the mortgage interest one, or excuse me, the itemized deductions on a married filing separate return. You can't take it unless, I mean, you've got to agree. And to take no more than 100%. And so they often don't talk to each other, and so they take all of it. And so we want to be able to just straighten that out.
Right. And you don't want to be caught in the middle of a highly emotional circumstance between two people who used to be married and aren't anymore.
Correct.
Right. Any other questions about these two, about this bill or the other, these two bills? Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on either of these measures? I don't see anyone. With that, we'll close the public hearing. We have 15 minutes, I think, to proceed with our property tax review. Kyle? Actually, it's more like 17 minutes. So.
public comment to.
So we'll open the what are we calling it? Information meeting on orientation toward our taxes.
Yeah, I'm support the chair.
And Cal, you're talking about property taxes today?
I am.
Thank you.
So yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. Yeah, I'll be touching on doing a brief overview of the property tax system, and then time permitting, I can go into property tax relief as well. But so I will be picking up again with the basic facts document. It is available in OLIS under the meeting materials, under the date, not under any bill, because it is an informational meeting. And property taxes begin on D1, or let's see, it's page 44 in the actual PDF. So the property tax system, for the most part, is going to be, it really is focused on local governments. It's a local tax. There is some connection, of course, to the state school fund, and through that, the general fund. Day of our office, we'll get into that probably in the next few days, time permitting. But for the most part, the property tax system really is a local tax, and it's based upon the local taxing district. So a property will reside within a county, maybe a city, a school district, and so forth. And the property taxes that are imposed on that property are based upon the property taxes imposed by those local government districts. When talking about the property tax system, there are really two fundamental component pieces that did come about in the 90s through voter initiatives, Measure 5, Measure 50. I believe Measure 5 is a reason why a number of you are here in the legislature to begin with, is what some of you mentioned. But a key takeaway before I'll go on, I'll describe them briefly, is Measures 5 and Measure 50 are in the Constitution. So there's plenty of room in statute to make tweaks within the property tax system, but if you're talking fundamental reform, it's going to go through the Constitution. So it's just something to keep in mind. Measure 5, which was passed in the early 90s, set overall taxing limits. And it set limits for both the education districts, that's K through 12, community colleges, and education service districts. They fall into a limit of $5 per 1,000 of real market value, so it's an overall taxing limit on the property. Anything that's not considered education falls into the general government category, and that has the limit of $10 per 1,000 of real market value. So Measure 5 just put in overall limits. That's on a property-by-property basis is where those limits get tested. A few years later, in the late 90s, was Measure 47 and Measure 50. And Measure 50 did two primary things. It changed the property tax system from a levy-based system to a rate-based system. The importance of that is, in the levy-based system, local government districts would go out for a certain amount that they required for their budgeting purposes, and they'd say, we need this dollar amount, and then you'd more or less back into a rate then impose against the properties. Under the rate-based system, based upon what was being imposed at the time of Measure 50 going into effect, districts, what was looked at was what the districts were imposing at that time, and then a rate was calculated at that time and set as a permanent rate for those government districts. So rather than having a levy, they now have a rate that was fixed more or less 20 years ago, and that's their permanent rate. Now, there still is the availability of local options and bond levies, of course, but the permanent rate for the district has been fixed based upon what was being imposed at the time that Measure 50 went through. The second component of Measure 50 was this real market value, maximum assessed value, or assessed value distinction. So at the time that Measure 50 came into effect, properties received an assessed value equal to 90% of their real market value. And then it's that assessed value is now limited to 3% growth year over year, where real market value can still go up and down. And now real market value is where the Measure 5 test is applied against to, but the tax rates are applied against the assessed value of the property. And that's where you really get this limit of 3% growth. It can be less, but no more than 3% growth for property taxes on a per property basis, ignoring local option levies or bond levies or something that takes a vote of the people within the district. So those are the fundamental pieces of the property tax system. A key component as well with Measure 50 is exemptions under a rate-based system work a little bit different from a local government standpoint. Under the levy system, if a property became exempt from property taxes, so it was taken off the roll, the districts were held more or less harmless because they would still impose the levy and they would just get a higher rate. under a rate-based system.
On everybody else. Right.
On everybody right. else, yes. It was, so if you exempt in a property, it shifted the tax liability of that property to everybody else within the districts and the code area and such. Under the rate-based system, you get a hybrid. So bonds are still imposed as a levy. So bonds still shift to other property owners. On average, it's about 20% of property taxes, but certainly less than that in certain areas. It depends. But the rest of it is actually a loss to the district. So it's a loss in revenue. So when you exempt the property, it does result in a loss now for local governments. So that's a key change as well. But that's where the system today is. I think, unless there's questions on the general overview, I'll go ahead and step into some of the trends in the property tax system.
I expect that we're going to revisit these two formulas that Kyle just described to us many, many times, because it's really easy to describe it. It's really hard to actually understand how it really works. So for the new members especially, I'll say that. Please, go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And I should note, the Measure 5 limits, that's where this idea of compression loss comes from. So you'll hear the term compression loss, and that's the loss. It's on a property by property basis when property is imposed higher than those rates can be imposed at. So it's compressed down. So maybe the imposed would be $2,000 for the property, but the Measure 5 limits say nope, the most you can impose is $1,800. So that loss would be $200. But that's how it gets reported as compression loss. So another key term to keep in mind. But so just sitting on a few of the trends and where we've seen on the imposed side, I will note the data that we have, the published data, is a year delayed. So what we're looking at is the 15-16 fiscal year. From a value standpoint, so the value of the property, so if you're looking at real market value or assessed value that's being reported for 15-16, that's actually based on January 1st, 2015. So it's even further delayed. So in some of the trends that we see in real market value and such going up, you will see those delayed a little bit from where you think they may be. So if you think that housing market's been speeding up, well, we're still back 2 years on what's being reported under the property tax data.
Can you describe why that is?
Yes, Mr. Chair. It's the nature of the way it's set up. So right now, if I use the property tax year we're in right now, so we're just in the 16-17 property tax year, the assessors will set the value of the property as of January 1 of 2016. So that's when they set the value, and then they do all the work of finding out, this was discussed a little bit at the committee, all the budget work that goes into it to set the rates and such, and then they extend the property later in the fall, and then it's due throughout the rest of the year. But so there is just this natural lag, as they have to set a date to value the property as of that date. And it's another reason why in the property tax system, a lot of times there's a lag too. If the state slips into a recession or comes out of a recession, property taxes might be a year or two behind that. So they might stay stronger for a year or two as we go into a recession, and they might lag coming out of it. Again, it depends the effect on the housing market and commercial property and the such, but another thing to keep in mind, I suppose.
So the valuation date of January 1, 2017 applies to a tax year that hasn't started yet.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And a payment to be made in November or in the installments that won't come for another, 9 months?
Yes. So the assessors right now, Mr. Chair, are working on valuing property as of this last month, and those will be the values used for the bills that go out this coming November. So, 10 months or so from now, or are due in November.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
No. Okay.
I just didn't want that to go past that too fast.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I'm trying to hit this at a very high level, and I apologize if I'm glossing over some things, so please do jump in. But so looking at this page D3, the 15-16 property taxes, the table shows the total imposed was, it did crest $6 billion overall for 15-16. That was a growth of about 4.8%. Now, that's the total imposed. That's the permanent local option and bond levies. And includes urban renewal as well. But that 4.8% is about on trend as well. We usually hover about 4.8, 4.9%. Growth rate has certainly changed post Measure 50, but that is since Measures 5 and 50, so the late 90s going into effect, it's averaging about 4.9%, I believe, year over year. So this last year was pretty much in line with the trend we've seen over the last 15 plus years. Just a note on some of the bonds, you can see there's some year-over-year decline. Bonds, of course, a large bond of a large district can definitely move, whether there's growth or there's decline year-over-year. So there is some variability in the bonds. But you can see for counties, it was nearly a 20% drop from the previous year.
Wow. Okay.
So skipping through, let's see. So I'll see if I can enlarge. Okay, so the next just exhibit that I would show you is the property value and average tax rate. This is going back from the 70s up to 2015. You can see the average tax rate. That's the line. It's the dotted line, and you can see pretty easily post Measure 5, Measure 50, the decline in the average tax rate, and this is against assessed value, and then it's remained pretty steady. And that's a reflection of the fact that, I mean, you have Measure 5, which is an overall limit, and the permanent rates were at that time. So there's no more movement with the levies. You just have a rate, and it gets applied to the assessed value. And you can also see the blue line there is the overall real market value in the state, and then the assessed value is the reddish-orange line. Mm. So assessed value has definitely stayed relatively steady, even through the housing bubble and the recession. You can pick out the real market value, the run-up, the drop in value, and now starting to see that increase again.
And these are measured in dollars?
Yes.
Unadjusted by anything?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So it's the total. So this would include growth in existing property value and new property that's being built and coming on the roll. That's all that lumped together. Okay. And then the next exhibit I wanted to point to is here at the bottom of page D8. And this is actually a new one we included this year in the basic facts. But what you're looking at is the statewide average tax imposed per $1,000 of real market value. So this is to the RMV of the property, and it's by district type. And you can see the overall is the blue line, and then the K through 12 ESDs, community college, that education side, mm-hmm. is the reddish-orange line again. And wow, I think this chart is helpful in showing some of that level shift that occurred with Measures 5 and Measure 50 coming into effect. So you can see the K through 12, or the education districts altogether, mm-hmm. was brought down. So the average imposed per 1,000 of RMV did make this level shift down to near that $5 limit that is imposed by Measure 5. And it stayed relatively flat. There's certainly some ups and downs, and that's reflective of overall valuation, real market values, and how that's moving. But it does give a good distinction of where that movement was and where it was prior to the changes in the 90s in both Measure 5 and Measure 50. Okay. And that covers what I wanted to hit on as the general overview. I'm happy to go into discussion of relief, or if you want to pick that up on a different...
Thank you. I think that's a great question. Let me ask one more. This is a great chart on page D8. What do you have a chart? Maybe you already passed it and I just missed it. That adjusts for inflation and for changes in the statewide real market value. Those would go opposite directions, I think. No, they would go the same direction, wouldn't they?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
I know they'd go the opposite direction. Sorry.
One of the other charts, it's not in the basic facts, but I've definitely circulated before, and I think it's one that gets picked up in the property tax statistics that DOR puts out annually. But it compares property taxes to personal income, which captures that a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And it shows relatively the same thing, where you had, I think it was at about 7% of personal income for a number of years, if not higher, and really shifted down to closer to 5%. And that has a way of accounting for inflation in a way. And this one would, as much as the real market value of property follows that same trend. I mean, certainly property could be moving different than the overall CPI or something.
This one really describes, doesn't it, visually, what happened to the school funds and why it was the legislature was in a horrendous trap in the 90s. And in my point of view, at least, continues to be in the same trap trying to fund K-12 with the same revenue stream that we used to not fund K-12 with, fund instead everything else. Representative Marsh.
Yes, on the same chart, the blue total line, does that comes in 15-16, a little bit above 10, maybe around 12. Does that represent compression above 10, or is that capital bonds, which aren't subject to compression?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh. That is overall imposed, so that would account if there is compression, but there is actually plenty of room. Not every property is in compression, and there's not rates that are all set at the $15 limit. So on the education side, it is closer, or a lot of them are even above the $5 per 1,000 of real market value. So if we move to a real market value tax system, mm-hmm. There's a lot more property that would be in compression. On the general government side, there's a lot more room under those limits, the $10 general government limit. So reflective of the fact that the blue line's not all the way up to the 15, it's just the fact that there is...
Oh, that's total with schools, too.
Yeah, okay. That's schools, gotcha. And the general
not
government.
Not just general.
Yes. Sorry, I think I missed your question.
Everything.
But
point. Wheeler.
It's interesting, though, on D8, the table, you know, there has been a significant growth rate of property taxes despite Measure 5 of 3.5%. Am I reading that correct?
Huh?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Buehler, you're looking at the, right there, the 3.5% for the 1990 to 2016, the average growth rate.
So
that's with, that was starting in 1990, so pre-Measure 5 and 50 as kind of the starting point and showing that throughout. And that would include you're getting the year-over-year growth in existing property and a new property build. Right. So it's including, both
so
of those.
So it's not like we've had a big decrease in property tax revenues despite Measure 5.
In dollars.
We've had an increase of 3.5%.
Yes, in nominal terms, Representative Buehler. And that's, I think, showing above is the average growth rate, if you go back to the 70s through 2016, is 5.7. And then it's from 1990 through 2016 is 3.5. So there's definitely there was a higher growth prior to Measure 5 and 50. So it really did slow that growth rate.
It slowed the
growth,
year.
But in nominal terms, yes, absolutely. You see year-over-year increases in property taxes, yes.
As long as we're on this interesting topic, I'm assuming that these taxes imposed, I don't know this. In the 80s, maybe in the 70s, the legislature bought down property taxes with general funds. I don't remember what that was exactly called. Is that reflected in this big drop that occurs from about 78 to 82, and then it sort of comes back and gets, by 1990, it's back up to what it was in 1972? I'm looking at D8 here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm skipping ahead, looking at some of the property tax relief, because I think you're referring to
E5 has the table.
E5 has the table. So we're getting ahead of ourselves, and I don't want to do that. We're over time for today. So instead of answering that question, let's carry it over. And we're going to carry over the information meeting, because it's not posted for tomorrow, but we're going to do it tomorrow anyway. And it will be posted as a carryover. And because we're over time already for today, I thank you for the presentation up to now, and we'll adjourn now and pick up this as part of our agenda tomorrow. And with that, committee is adjourned.